Well, good morning. Is that me?
Yep.
One of these days, I'm going to find out who it is every Sunday morning who turns that air.
Me too.
Turns it off?
No, it turns it. Well, this morning we're going to be talking about the principle of reciprocation. Maybe that will apply to what we just talked about. What goes around comes around. Ain't that what they say?
Bring the mic in.
Bring the mic in. Is it on, Craig? Okay. About time for some hearing aids, Cindy. We're going to be looking at Luke chapter 6, verses 37 to 42. And to start with, before we read the text, I want to talk a little bit about different words. The words laws, principles, and cute sayings. See if we can distinguish between those things. Start out with laws. What is a law? If we were to define that, it would be something that is unchangeable, that is certain to take place. At least that's the way I'm going to define it right now. I know that there are laws that God gives for us to obey that we certainly don't obey. But I'm talking about there are laws in nature, there are laws in life that are always the same. For instance, the law of gravity. If you get on top of a building today and jump off, you're going to hit the ground because of the law of gravity. If you do it tomorrow, the same thing is going to happen tomorrow. The sun comes up in the east, and it has every day for quite a while. And it's just a law. Now, God can supernaturally impose upon those laws if he so chooses. But we can depend on them to be there. You do a ton of things every day trusting in laws. Okay? We talk about if you plant whatever you sow, that will you reap. You plant corn kernels, what do you expect to come up? Corn, right? Water freezes at what temperature? 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and it will always freeze at 32 degrees Fahrenheit unless something alters that. And that, in this case, would be an alteration of pressure. Can raise or lower the freezing point of water as well as the boiling point of water. But laws are things that are unchanging. Let's go to principles. Principles are sort of like laws, except that they are generally true. Generally true. Sometimes you might could call those proverbs in a way, but they are things that you can depend on because they are generally true, but there are exceptions. I just gave you one under laws of whatever you sow, that will you reap. I call that a law. It is also a principle in some instances because there are many times that I have sown things that I'm glad I didn't reap what I had sown or didn't appear that I reaped it. So it can be a principle as well. Then we get to cute sayings. Let me give you one. When it rains, it pours. Is that a law? Is it a principle? No. Then what does it mean? When it rains, it pours. Somebody enlighten me what that means. Do what?
Like Morton Salt.
Like Morton Salt? Somebody besides Don tell me what that means. Okay, when something bad happens, it seems like five more happen in a short period of time, it seems like. At least it seems that way to us. And so we have this saying, when it rains, it pours. Okay? Of course, that saying probably was invented by some pessimistic guy somewhere, you know, and that's, it kind of stuck. What is Murphy's Law? Somebody tell me what that is. If anything bad can happen, is it bad can happen? If anything can go wrong, I think that's the way it's properly worded. If anything can go wrong, it will. That's called Murphy's Law. Is that a law? No. We call it Murphy's Law, but it's not. Is it a principle? No. It's just a cute little saying that we all have heard before in our life. And the other thing I want to mention is in Luke's gospel, in this chapter, maybe it's probably not as much as any other chapter. I don't know about that. But it seems like the points that he makes, maybe two or three verses long or five or six verses long, and it seems like he goes to a different subject. And our text this morning, there are like three different things here that I've tried to make them fit with each other, and I just can't do it. And I'm not going to try to force something that perhaps is not there. Someone has said that the Jewish way of teaching was do it in short increments of different subject matter to get the audience's attention back to the forefront when you start something new. And they suggested perhaps that's how Luke is writing, but I don't know about that either. But we're going to read these verses and then talk about a few things. So let's begin reading verse 37, where Jesus says, "Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you." And he spoke a parable to them. "Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into the ditch? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not perceive the plank that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Brother, let me remove the speck that is in your eye,' when you yourself do not see the plank that is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck that is in your brother's eye." So let's look at these. We'll start with the first two verses, 37 and 38. In these verses, there are two principles given in a negative way. And then there are two given in a positive way. The two negative ones are "judge not" and "condemn not." The two positive ones are "forgive" and "give." All right, so let's look at those. The "judge not" one, we're going to, what I say the other day, come full circle. We're going to talk about this later on, the very last thing. So we're going to skip it for now. The second one is "condemn not." What does that mean? What does the word "condemn" mean? Well, it means to pronounce someone as guilty. Pronounce someone as guilty. And so when it tells us to don't condemn, it is telling you not to conclude that a person is a certain way. And all of these things, let me just go ahead and say this, all of these things are not exclusive prohibitions to do certain things. They are just saying that whichever way you condemn, with what haste you condemn, or with what carelessness you condemn, that's the way people will treat you. Same way with forgiving, same thing with giving, same thing with judging. All right, none of these things, or especially the negative ones, are strict prohibitions not to do them. But he's saying, don't condemn in such a way that you would not want condemnation coming back to you. Now, this, I think, is most common in what is supposed to be perhaps things that we know a lot about, or we think we know a lot about it, we're supposed to know a lot about it, those type things. And let me give you an example of that. I was a building contractor for a little over 30 years around here. And over most of those years, I had a practice that I don't think is a bad practice. But as I drove down the road, you know, I would look at houses. And if I saw a house that, in my opinion, was ugly, it might have been newly built, but it was an ugly house. I would ask myself the question, why is that unattractive? What did they do wrong, or what should have been done different that this house would look better? And I wasn't doing it to condemn the builder or the homeowner. I was doing it to try to learn something that, you know, I might could foresee somewhere down the road. So it wasn't that I was condemning in a wrong sense, I don't believe. But sometimes we tend to, I could have the tendency to, if someone spoke about a builder or something, then I thought that this guy doesn't have a good reputation or whatever. Is it necessary for me to just tell everybody that I see about that? No, it's not. But we have a tendency to say these sentences. You know, they may say, this guy's good at this, and we may have the tendency to come out with those two words, yes, but, and share what we know, share what we think. When somebody does something and they're not the best at it, why in the world do we have to point that out to anyone? All right? But we have the tendency to do that, to be negative. Yes, but. Condemn not. The next one is to forgive. This word comes from two different Greek words. It means to loosen off of, to take off of. Now, this loosening off of can be done to both the person who offended you and yourself. All right, for instance, if I offend someone and do something that's wrong and I have to go and ask their forgiveness, and I ask their forgiveness and they forgive me, when I leave that place, how do I feel? Lighter, right? The burden has been lifted and I have been forgiven. What would it be like, do you suppose, that we could be face to face with Jesus Christ in our lifetime and hear him say, and know our sin, our grievous sin, and ask his forgiveness and hear him say to us audibly, you are forgiven. It seems like to me that would be such a glorious experience to hear the God of heaven tell me I am forgiven. What if that person doesn't give a rip about whether you forgive him or not? He wrongs you and he doesn't care, doesn't bother him. And you go to him and you say, hey, I'll forgive you for what you did. What does that do? He looks at you like you're crazy. And is that what we ought to do? I don't necessarily think so myself. All right? If a person has wronged me and they don't care that they've wronged me, all right, I don't think I'm obligated to go to them and tell you, hey, I forgive you. All right? But I need to forgive them in my own spirit. And if I don't do that, it ends up harming me as much or more than it does them. George Washington Carver. Anybody know who George Washington Carver was? All you old folks, they probably don't teach him in school anymore. George Washington Carver made a statement that, at least I thought he made it. I heard it years ago and I tried to find it and couldn't. But I found a lot of other things that he said. I don't know if you know much about him and his communications, but I think he wrote a few books that I'm going to see if I can find and read them. The guy's pretty sharp. He was a black man, and he was born, I think, about the year the Civil War ended. So he was 30 or 40 years old around the turn of the 19th century or the 20th century. And he made a statement, so you can imagine kind of the era in which he lived. He made a statement, I'm not going to quote this right, but he said, I will never again let a man make me bitter by dwelling on and not forgiving him for how he's wronged me. That guy's pretty sharp. I've seen people, you have seen people, who have been hurt, and they cannot, they go through years and years of their life bitter. Bitter and angry and wishing harm upon someone. And the hurt and the harm comes to them. Forgive. Now that doesn't mean that you have to like them, I hope. I think I've forgiven a person or three that I really don't like. It doesn't mean that I have to invite them for supper once a week. All right? It may mean that we still have are going to have differences. You know, their values are different than mine. It just may mean that I've still got to just keep my distance. It may mean that I don't trust them. Can't just turn on trust. All right? Just because I'm supposed to forgive someone doesn't mean I'm supposed to trust them. So there's those issues all come into play. And we've seen last week and this week as well, there are things that are so intertwined with these things, it's not so black and white as it might seem. The fourth one was to give. We talked last week about this idea of giving, expecting nothing in return. And I think that same idea is here as well. To give, expecting nothing in return. It's that kind of giving. It's the kind of giving that doesn't look for reasons not to give. It's the kind of giving that looks for ways in which I can give. To balance that again, we always got these things to balance things. It's to give responsibly. Right, if someone is, their finances are wrecked because they can't quit buying lottery tickets or they can't quit doing this or they can't quit doing that, I don't think that God, that I am obligated to buy them groceries. I don't. I mean, God would have to really beat it into my head. To make me believe that, all right? To give. The general principle of all these things and of others is in the last line of verse 38. For, he says, with the same measure that you measure, it will be measured back to you. A general principle. In general, the way you behave, the way you give, the way you judge, the way you condemn, the way you forgive these things, the same manner in which you do it, generally speaking, you'll see the same come to you, the same ideas reciprocated. Now let's go to number two. Now this is a little, if I was writing an essay and wrote this sentence, I'd probably get a bad grade. The unlearned must listen to the learned in order to learn. The unlearned must listen to the learned in order to learn. Let's see what he says in verse 39. Can the blind lead the blind? What's the obvious answer there? No. Will they not both fall into the ditch? Now notice in this question, both of these people are blind. Both of them are blind. And one of them decides he will lead this blind man around. And so he can't see where he's going, so he ends up falling in the ditch. If someone were to tell me that, boy, I'm don't know what I want to do with my life, I think I'll be a brain surgeon. And I could tell them, hey, just come with me, I'll show you how to do that. There's the blind leading the blind. If someone wants to be a trapeze artist and walk across a tightrope, they've never done it before, and I say, hey, I'll show you how to do that. We're not going to make it too far, all right, because I don't know how to do it either. Can the blind lead the blind? No. The answer, obviously, is no. But then he asks another question, or makes a statement, in verse 40. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. Now, this seems like it ought to be connected to the previous question. And in a way, I can see how that it is, but I don't want to make too strong a connection there. But here's the question I've got on the outline there. Is it possible for a disciple to surpass his teacher? Yes, it is. All right? Now, if we're looking at this and we think of Peter, James, and John as being the disciples and Jesus as the teacher, then our answer would be no. We cannot surpass Jesus if that's our teacher, either in our ideals, our morals, our behavior, or anything of the kind. But this idea of having a teacher and a disciple is applicable in many other ways than besides us and Jesus. For instance, some people are, you see I have on here, incompetent. Now, I don't mean that they're stupid or that they're ignorant. They're just not gifted to be able to do everything that they would have the opportunity to do. Susan's got a brother. Many of you know her brother. When he was a kid, like 4 years old, or then 6 or 8 or 10 years old, his mother had Susan and Brian taking ballet lessons. Why are y'all laughing? Because you know Brian, right? Brian worked for the highway department, Brian's always up to something, you know, just cutting up and everything. And he can dish it out a lot better than he can take it. And the guys down at the highway department just would rag him. If they ever found out anything on him, they would just rag him to no end. And Susan made sure but on his birthday, she would send a photograph of him as a little boy doing something, you know. And a ballet picture of him. I think he was in a little Indian costume or whatever. I'm not sure the details, but that was a good one. All right. When he got a little older, 8 or 10 years old, his mother decided that him and Susan needed to start taking piano lessons. He took, I don't know how many lessons, I suspect it wasn't but 3 or 4. And Susan said that the teacher told her mother one day after the lesson, I suppose, she said, look, you're wasting your time and my money, or your money and my time trying to teach this boy to play the piano. So that was the end of that. It wasn't that Brian is stupid. It's just that he's not a piano player. He's not a ballet dancer. All right? He's incompetent in those things. If he has a piano teacher, he will never, or probably would, never rise to his piano teacher's level. He'd never rise above his teacher. On the other hand, you have people who are super competent. Okay, I don't know how many of y'all remember Jennifer Nelson. When the Nelsons were here, she played the keyboard for a year or so when she was 16, maybe. All right, she took piano lessons. I don't know when she started, 12 or 13, I'm not sure. But I can guarantee you, by the time she was 16, her teacher wasn't teaching her anything. All right, her teacher might have been teaching her music theory. But what she was teaching her was the mathematics of music. She wasn't teaching her how to play. Right? Because she could, I don't know who her teacher was. But I'm guessing the odds are really great that she had surpassed her teacher's abilities at a young age. A super competent person in that area. So we see these things. the learner, he says, will follow, will be like his master. One who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. Now this, you listen to me for a second, this is why it is so risky to delegate the learning of your children to just anybody. Because they, as a child, you're telling them, and nowadays you ought not to tell them this, you ought to tell them something contrary to this, but they're expected to believe the teacher is right. Aren't they? They are. Let me tell you, it is hard for a six-year-old to determine when her teacher is right and when her teacher is wrong. It's hard at six, it's hard at eight, it's hard at 10. By the time they're 16, you're a little late. It's risky to just give their education or anything else in their learning to someone who you don't trust completely with their morals and with their understanding of Scripture. And yet, I believe my whole life, most of you older folks have too, where that was never questioned that I remember by my parents. Nowadays, you better question. You better watch it. You better be looking. Because there are people there who will intentionally lead your child down a wrong path and completely, intentionally hide it from you. The back page, we're going back to the judgment. Judge not, you shall not be judged. Now, the reason I want to go back to this is because in Matthew's account, I've got the reference there, Matthew 7, 1 to 6, Matthew puts together that statement, judge not that you be not judged, with the idea of the speck in your brother's eye and the beam in your own eye. He puts those two things together and adds a verse at the end of it. So what I want us to do is go to the book of Matthew. Keep your place there in Luke. We're going to read the first six verses of the book of Matthew. Matthew chapter 7, 1 to 6. Where Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judged, you will be judged. See, there's that idea. It's not a prohibition exclusively against judging, but it's a prohibition or a warning, rather, to watch how you judge. Watch how you make judgments. Because how you make judgments, generally speaking, is the way people are going to make them toward you. And with what measure you use, and it will be measured to you again. Verse 3, and why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite. First remove the plank from your own eye, then you shall see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now we're going to come back to this last verse, verse 6. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and tear you, and turn and rend you or tear you in pieces. Now, the reason I want to talk about this kind of at a little bit more length is because this is a verse that is the rallying cry of everyone who hates God, of everyone who does not like Christianity, of everyone who wants to live their life the way they want to live it. This is their cry if you challenge them. Judge not that you be not judged. I heard 20 years ago, I think it was Josh McDowell that had said that John 3:16 was no longer the most quoted verse in the Bible. The most quoted verse was Matthew 7, 1. Judge not that you be not judged. Now that is a weird turn of events, isn't it? So, and the reason I want to talk about it is because I want us to be equipped to not be intimidated by someone who would throw that at us. Don't judge me. So we're going to talk about what all that means. You can look in the Bible. The first thing you run across is there's a book of the Bible named Judges. All right? Somebody name one of those judges. Anybody know how many judges were there in the book of Judges? I don't know. I'll just see if anybody knows. I think it's 7 or 8 or something like that. Can anybody name one? Samson?
Deborah?
Gideon? Jephthah? Some guy that killed somebody. Several others. Was Ehud one of them? That's who I was kind of thinking about, but he may have been the one that got killed. I don't know. Anyway, we don't know. But there are some judges there. What do you think those guys were doing? Judging. Right? That's why they named them judges, because their task is to judge. The word judge means, and I've got 4 words here, to decide, to determine, to distinguish, and to discern. You ever done any of those things? How often do you do them? Every day, multiple times a day, you'd make decisions. Multiple times a day, you determine one thing or another. Multiple times a day, you distinguish between your right hand and your left. Multiple times a day, you have to discern something. That's what the word judge means. So do you judge? Yes. Every day, all day long, you're judging. So first of all, when someone tells you, don't judge me, you can't help it. You're just going to have to do it. You can't do what they tell you to do. All right, now I'm going to read. I've got some verses there. That was the tip of the iceberg. The word judge, judges, judgment, judging. Any form of the word judge is found in the Bible hundreds of times. And probably half of those, I will concede, are in the context of the usage, is God is the one that's talking, that is doing the judging. But other times, it's a lot of other times, sometimes it's nations or government rulers, a civil judge. But a lot of times it is you and me. We're told to judge. Sometimes it's judgments that are made bad, okay? And sometimes it is orders or commands, imperatives to judge. Now, I've got some there, just a few there. You can look up the word to see, but I want to look at one. This is just about a page or two over in your Bibles. That's the reason I wanted to pick it. But Luke chapter 7, verse 43, and I'm going to back up and tell you the story beginning in verse 36. Now, you can, if you want to kind of generally follow along, see if I tell it right, that's okay. There is no 743? Luke. I think say your Bible ain't like my Bible. I got one here. Luke 7. Yep. Luke said we're going to hone in on verse 43. But I'm going to tell you the context that begins in verse 36. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to come eat with him. So Jesus goes. He's there eating. You know how they recline, you know, kind of sit on their... I guarantee you I wouldn't weigh as much as I weigh if I had to eat like that. But reclining maybe on their elbow or whatever, and they're eating and their feet's kind of behind them, sitting on the floor. But this woman comes in. And I don't know who she was. It's not, at least in this account, it doesn't tell us anything about her except she was a sinner. Now, we might assume that the woman was a prostitute. I don't know. She might have been a thief. I don't know what she was, other than she was a sinner. And she came in with an alabaster flask of fragrant oil. She stood at his feet behind him, weeping. She began to wash his feet with her tears. And she wiped them with the hair on her head. She kissed his feet and anointed them with this fragrant oil. The Pharisee, who's we're in his house here in this scene, the Pharisee sees what's going on, and in his mind, he thinks this, this man, Jesus, this man that I invited here, I know for sure he's not a prophet. Because if he had been a prophet, he would have known what kind of woman this is. He's allowing to touch him. As far as we know, he doesn't say it out loud. But Jesus knows his thoughts. And Jesus perhaps knows that Simon Peter is having similar thoughts. Maybe not. But he says to Simon Peter, Simon, I've got something I want to tell you. Simon says, say on. Let's hear it. And Jesus tells him this little short story. A man loaned out money. And he loaned out money to two men. One of them, he loaned 500 pence. I don't know what that is. Let's say it's $10,000. And the other guy loaned 50 pence. Let's say whatever that would be, comparatively speaking, $1,000 or whatever. And over the course of time, neither one of them could repay him. And he just abruptly forgave both of them their debt. So you don't have to pay me. And then Jesus asked Peter a question. Who do you think loved that man the most? I don't think Peter appeared to take too long to answer. But I think he did think about it. He had time to think that question. It wouldn't take me too long to answer that question. Especially if I could put those two words in front. I suppose. Right? He said, I suppose it would be the man that owed him the most. We're in verse 43. What does Jesus say? Peter, you have rightly judged. You have rightly judged. You have thought about this, and you've thought about the answer, and you had to make a decision. You had to make a judgment, and that is your judgment. And Jesus said, that's a good judgment. You have rightly judged. Jesus goes on, and he says, you see this woman? I entered the Pharisee's house. It's the Simon the Pharisee. No, this ain't Simon Peter. It's the man the Pharisee, right? Yeah, I learned something. Okay, he says to the Pharisee, Simon, not Simon Peter, Simon the Pharisee, since I came into your house, this woman has not ceased washing my feet, wiping my feet with the hair on her head, kissing my feet. You didn't. You didn't anoint my head with oil when I came in, but this woman has not ceased to anoint my feet. You gave me no kiss. She's not ceased to kiss my feet. Therefore I say to you, he says in verse 47, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Now, I want to ask you this question. What all judgments were made in this story? When the world, and we're going to come back to this, when the world looks at you and the world says, judge not, that you be not judged. They don't even know what the other part means. They just know, judge not. Practically, all of the time, somebody throws that at you, here's what they're meaning. Don't tell me my sin is wrong. Isn't it? I would say practically every time that's the issue. They are living in such a way that they know you disapprove, and if you just cross your eyes at them wrong, they're going to throw this at you. But you cannot help but judge. They cannot help but judge. When they tell you, judge me not, do not judge me, what are they doing? They're judging. They're doing the very thing they tell you you're not supposed to do, but they're doing. They are judging you for judging them. When you determine that someone's behavior is good, you're judging. When you determine that someone's behavior is bad, you're judging. The issue is not whether or not you're going to judge. The issue is whether or not your judgments are righteous judgments. Jesus said that in John 7:24. Judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgments. Now back to the story. Let's walk through some of the judgments that were made in this account. Simon the Pharisee makes a judgment. He makes a judgment as to whether or not to invite Jesus to his house. He makes a judgment as to whether or not this is going to fly very well with his Pharisee friends. He might have been a setup all along. They may have been in on it. I don't know. He makes that judgment. This woman comes in, and Simon the Pharisee makes a judgment. He makes a judgment as to what kind of woman this is. He makes another judgment when he sees Jesus not recall and be repulsed by this woman. He makes a judgment there. And from those two judgments, he makes a conclusion that Jesus is not a prophet. And this thing just rolls on, doesn't it? He made one right judgment, and that was that the man who was owed most would love most. The issue is not whether or not we will judge. It's what kind of judgments we will be making. Verses 41 and 42 are back in the book of or Luke 6. Is start with judging ourselves. Luke 6, verses 41 and 42. While you look at the speck in your brother's eye, you see something in your brother's eye, and it's there, and you know he ought to know about it, you know he ought to quit it, it's a sin of something, and you tell him, well, you've got problems of your own that you're not dealing with. You reckon that he's going to listen? I doubt it. We've heard a little saying that says, do as I say, not as I do. Is that a law? Is it a principle? Is it a cute saying? Not really. We understand our tendency to do that, and so we kind of chuckle at it. But we know this is, if truth be known, this is not funny. Now, in the book of Matthew adds a verse that we don't see in Luke. And I want to hone in on that just for a second. In Matthew, Jesus ends this account on judging with this verse. Give not that which is holy to the dogs. Neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn again and rend you. Now let's look at this and ask ourselves a few questions. Who are the dogs and the swine? Now these are parallel statements. Remember we talked about that last week. Kind of saying the same thing two different ways. Give not that which is holy to the dogs. Don't cast your pearls before swine. Those two statements are pretty well saying the same thing. Just a different picture in your mind. Who are the dogs and who are the swine? They are sinners. I'm going to say it this way. They are persons needing to be confronted with their sin or their foolishness. The dogs and the swine in this account, and I know that's an ugly an analogy that he uses dogs and pigs, but that's what it represents. It represents people who need to be confronted with their sin or with their foolishness. So, give not that which is holy to the dogs. Don't cast your pearls before swine. What is that which is holy, and what is your pearls? All right? In my opinion, those things are this. They are your reproofs. They are your wisdom. They are things that you say that have what I call verbal value. Things that you tell someone that is worth listening to. So what does he say? Don't give your wisdom. Don't give your advice to dogs. Don't give your pearls, the things that you say that have extreme value for life, to the pigs. Now this gives us another piece of information about these dogs and these pigs. Not only are they wallowing in their sin and their foolishness, but they have no desire to hear what you say. They will not listen. And it's that kind of person that Jesus is talking about here when he says, do not give that which is holy to the dogs. Don't give your advice on how to live life that is right and it is of extreme value to the swine, because they're not wanting it. They will not listen. Have you ever been there?
Yeah.
I have. I have. You have. Some of you may be there right now. That is a miserable way to live. A miserable life. Having to go through your day casting aside the things that are good to remain in the gutter. Why do the dogs trample these things under their feet? Why do the pigs and the swine trample them in the mud that they are wallowing in? Why do they do that? Because they see absolutely no value in what you are saying. Now, let's talk about judging again. Just from verse 6. Give not that which is holy to the dogs. How many judgments do you have to make in order to apply that verse? First of all, you've got to determine if a person needs correcting. Now, that's a dangerous affair right there, isn't it? Okay? You've got to determine, does this person need correcting? Is their behavior or their lifestyle, whatever it is, such that someone ought to intervene and tell them they're wrong? Okay? Especially if it's a parent, obviously it's their job to do that. They're responsible to do that. So the first judgment that has to be made is, does this person need correcting? The second thing that has to be determined is this person a dog? Already decided they need correcting. Are they a dog? That is, I'm trying to evaluate whether or not they're going to listen to what I say. Right? That's a judgment that you're going to make. You're going to make it. It's not if you decide to make it. You're going to make it. The next judgment that you make is if the risk that I'm taking in confronting them worth it? Are they going to just trample what I say on the ground under their feet? Are they going to just disregard it as foolishness? Is it worth the risk? There have been many times in my life, and I'm sure it has come my way as well, but where I wanted to talk to someone who was a friend. And it wasn't a horrible issue of murder or something, but I wonder, is the friendship worth the risk of talking to them about this? I'm risking them getting angry, and that's the end of it. Should I just live with it and still have a friend? Is it worth that kind of risk? There's a proverb. I used to know where it was at. I forgot that. It says this: a wise man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. A wise man foresees the evil. He looks ahead and he sees where the path he is on is going to carry him. And he makes a judgment to either continue on that path or to hide himself or to withdraw and get away from the evil. My life has dogs and swine scattered throughout it. Perhaps if I'm your friend, your life has dogs and swine in it too. I may be the dog. I may be the swine. But our lives are that way. And we have to judge how to live appropriately with those people. It might be children. It might be parents. It might be cousins. It might be a coworker. Whatever it is, we have to do it. You will do it. It's not a matter of putting it off. You will do it. Whether to limit your exposure to such people or whatever it is. The last statement is this: be careful when you make judgments. You will make them. The way you make them, as a general rule, will be reciprocated back to you. Let's pray.